Hello, everybody, and happy Friday. This is Cairo Knights producer Sugar Shane Peterson, and I've got a whole lineup of some reruns here for you, a best of show, one may say. So I hope everybody's ready for a nice, calming evening, and I hope you're all ready for the Memorial Day weekend. We're kicking it off with a good one. This is when Diamond Dave Ross came in to talk to Jack about the Republicans' big lie and Joe Biden's polling numbers.
All right, joining us is a young broadcaster, so let's take it easy on him. He's 15 years old from WVIP in Mount Kisco, New York, a young man named Dave Ross. Dave Ross.
Yes.
Such an amazing...
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me on your show. The only talk show that broadcasts from a packed stadium. It's amazing.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that, Dave Ross. Yeah, that's our live studio audience. They they love to pop in every so often, and for some reason, they almost exclusively agree with me, which is interesting.
I noticed that.
So, Diamond Dave Ross, always a gem, as we like to call you on Cairo Knights, whenever we comment on one of your many commentaries, or whenever we think about or in appreciation of all the VO work that you've done for us. I wanted to have you on because I wanted to talk about this article from The Guardian that basically was saying that the big lie and people who supported the big lie had a pretty good night last night in terms of the off-year elections. And the author of this article refers to it as a sign of Trump's enduring power. I have done, Dave, I don't know how many segments trying to debunk the big lie that Trump actually won the election. I went through beat by beat all of the claims that were made in the documentary 2000 Mules by Dinesh D'Souza. I have been banging my head against the wall now for about 2 years trying to explain to people that some of the inconsistencies that they thought that they saw during the election did not actually happen. For instance, a very famous photograph shows Ethernet cables going into the back of voting machines in places like Georgia or Pennsylvania. And I try to explain to people that those are actually going to a server. They're not actually an external Ethernet cable.
Were you actually there? Right. Were you there, Jack? Did you follow the cable yourself? Or are you simply believing what the mainstream media tells you?
Well, you know, I just, you know, when you have an election official, let's just say from the state of Georgia, who testifies under penalty of perjury that those Ethernet cables were going to close servers, I think at that point in time, it's kind of open and shut at that point in time, but for many people, they refuse to believe it. So I'm curious, Dave, from your perspective as a commentator, how do you interpret this? How do you navigate this? Because it's been impossible for me to do it for 2 years.
It's easy for me to navigate. I do not debate people whose minds are already made up. As you know, people know what they believe before they know why they believe it. I think that's been proven repeatedly by psychologists, and what they're very entertained by fact checkers like you, Jack. They love sending you on these scavenger hunts for clues. It doesn't matter how many facts you collect. There's always a reason why you're wrong. They know full well that Trump lost the election, but they want to flood the zone with all these rumors so that the fact checkers will run donuts in the grass and get nowhere with them.
Yeah,
because they're going to keep saying this because, first of all, it's fun for them, and it gets them clicks. And of course, there are a lot of websites that make a lot of money selling ads because it's a big club. You know, it's an identity, and I think people enjoy it. I think they know full well they didn't win the election. Every time you scratch the surface of these conspiracy theories, you realize it would be physically impossible. It would violate the laws of physics for it to happen as they claimed.
Yeah, and the more that I, because I'll be honest with you, Dave, when the election first happened, I want to say maybe 24 hours after the results came in, and there was that kind of quote unquote overnight ballot dump, I was one of those people who thought, well, wait a minute, this is unbelievably suspicious. I was doing the overnights on Cairo that night, and I saw in real time a huge amount of votes come in. And I don't know if it was because I was sleep deprived. I don't know if it's because that was my particular state of mind, but I thought, oh, this is unbelievably suspicious, because I was watching the returns as they were coming in at 4 o'clock in the morning. And then quickly, within about 72 hours, I went, oh, this has gotten way out of control. This paranoia, or this perception that there is some kind of tomfoolery going on, is getting, the momentum on this is building so fast that I don't think anybody's going to be able to stop it. And then Sidney Powell comes out, and then Giuliani comes out, and they've got the Kraken, and then they release the Kraken. And my favorite moment from the last year or last months of Rush Limbaugh's life was when he got the Kraken, as Sidney Powell called it, and he starts his radio show and he says, now, hold on. There's nothing here. So even the great Rush Limbaugh said there's nothing here, right?
I guess for most of the country, the idea of mail-in ballots is a novelty.
Yeah.
I mean, there's always been the option of mailing in ballots, absentee ballots. We used to call them when I was growing up in New York. And you had to have an excuse. But in terms of ballot integrity, there's nothing more secure than the paper ballot system that we have here in Washington State, where everybody has an individual barcode. If you were to Xerox a bunch of fake votes, the machines would pick it up instantly. Right. Back in the day, we were voting by voting machines. There was no way to see where your vote was. You went into a machine, you closed the curtain, you threw a couple of levers, right? And then you pulled a bigger lever that opened the curtain, and those levers all popped back into place. Were your votes counted? You had no idea. I mean, we always assumed the machine was counting that vote.
Yeah.
There were little counters that the poll watchers would eventually read out at the end of the night. There's no printed record anywhere. And yet people accepted those results. Now you got a receipt for everything. So it's almost like your bank statement. I mean, I can now get, I don't get my checks returned anymore, the physical checks, but I can go on and get a picture of every check I ever wrote.
Yeah.
And in the same way, they have a barcode for every ballot. The only thing they can't do is match it to your name, because we have a secret ballot. Now, at this point, if you wanted to campaign for something, it would be to just end the secret ballot. Why shouldn't we know how people vote and hold them accountable for that, since these decisions are pretty important? And that way, you can quite easily check if a vote is phony or not. You look at a ballot, if it's crinkled or you can't understand the mark, you call up the voter and you say, who did you intend to vote for? And then we count it that way. I mean, I suppose that's the only way to satisfy anybody, but you'd be giving up the secret ballot. As I recall, though, I think in Britain, the way they are, maybe it's Canada, the way they vote, they all gather in a precinct room and they just fill out a piece of paper and it's counted right there in the room.
Oh,
so
wow.
Everybody can see the votes being counted, and you don't have this problem. But if you're going to have an election in a country as big as ours with, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of votes, that would be pretty awkward. So, you need to go on a different campaign, Jack, because you're not going to convince these people to change their minds, no matter how much evidence you come up with.
Yeah, and I've been thinking about that more and more, especially when I get these long-winded emails from listeners that are just so mad, Dave. They are like, they're just so angry that, oh, Jack, how could you possibly watch the movie 2000 Mules and not come away with the same conclusion? What is management at Cairo telling you to say? I mean, they get really paranoid and very embittered. And I realized something in the most recent one that I got is from about 3 or 4 days ago. It was a gentleman. He sends me this long email, and he says he basically goes through his gripes about Joe Biden as a president, who, by the way, has pretty low approval ratings as of today, according to a recent poll, about 39%. So pretty bad. But he goes through all of his anger and frustration with Joe Biden as the president of the United States, and all of his anger and frustration about COVID-19 and Jay Inslee, and all of his anger and frustration around, basically anything that could happen in his life. And it seems like the focal point of all of that for him is that moment in November of, 2 years ago, where he views that as the pivotal moment. That is where everything started going wrong in his life. And I think it's much more of a psychological fixation on that event than the actual truth of it. Meaning if only things had happened, if only Donald Trump had been in office, my life wouldn't be so miserable.
It would be better.
Yeah.
Huh. But when people email me with those stories, I ask them, what is it that is going on in your life? And sometimes it's an employer who had an employee who stole something or didn't show up for work, or somebody lost their job, or somebody's rent went up, or something's not going right in their lives. And so they have to focus on some reason for that, or some person to get angry at. And sometimes that's what it is. And I mean, I don't blame people who are having difficulty or find themselves in a box because of some circumstance they're in. The only problem is when this becomes a national meme such that people no longer trust the democratic system.
Right. Yeah.
And then we're in trouble, because it's like if people suddenly realized, you know, this money in my wallet, these are just pieces of paper. You know, the emperor has no clothes here. This has no value. What are we doing? We all live with these little the society depends on these fictional devices, things like money and manners and trust in voting. And when you lose that, that's when the anarchists take over. And then it's ruled by whoever is the most ruthless, you know, like what's going on in Ukraine.
Yeah. And I wonder where this one of the worst things that Donald Trump ever did as president is when he cast doubt on the democratic system, when he effectively dipped his toe into the fascist jacuzzi and said, this system cannot be trusted. It's rotten to the core. And that 30 million individual base just went right in with him. And they just said, yep, daddy says it, so it's got to be true. And now you have people who are now being voted into office in Pennsylvania and in Kentucky who are ardent supporters of this idea. It is a reality to them. And that's what I find the most concerning, is that when we get these hardliners in there who fundamentally believe that the system is corrupt and broken in terms of our voting process, what extreme measures will they then go to quote unquote ensure that that will not happen again?
Right. Well, that's the plan, is to have these election committees in the various states cast doubt on each state's results such that it's thrown to the legislatures. And that's the plan that John Eastman, that White House attorney, was hatching for January 6th. Because, yes, under the Constitution, the members of Congress voting as delegations, which means it goes according to state by state, can select the president. And if there's enough chaos on election night, then they would make a case for that to happen. And in that case, whoever, you know, whichever party has the most states, not necessarily the most votes, gets to choose the president. And that appears to be the grand plan here in electing state officials who, I guess, are willing to lie about the ballot count.
Yeah, and then you have to then ask yourself, like, do you want that kind of person? I guess that there are people are out there, though, who do want that kind of person in there based, I guess, on their cultural preferences or their political preferences.
Yeah.
And that is such a dangerous place, I feel, for the United States to be in, where this kind of win at any costs mentality, as opposed to understanding the system itself. It's this, if I don't get what I want, then the system is rigged. And if I don't get the outcome that I want, then I will force it to be so. And I can think of nothing more kind of anti-GOP or anti-conservative than that kind of mindset, right? I will physically I will lie and cheat and steal in order to get the result that I want.
Well, they hate the government. Unless it's doing
right.
What they want,
yeah.
I guess, in which case it's great. When it comes to, you know, tracking down women to make sure they carry their pregnancies through, then, I mean, that would take quite a bit of government interference if you're going to actually do that for every pregnant woman in America. That, to me, would be a big government, but nobody minds that, apparently. I don't know what to do about it, except historically, what's happened is eventually they win. You know, the dog catches the car, and then it backfires. But that is a long, tedious, painful, destructive process.
Dave Ross, you're the best. I appreciate you coming on. And I think you got a bright future in the world of broadcast radio, if I could say that.
My dream is to broadcast to a stadium full of adoring fans who accept my every word.
I mean, you know, as a young 15-year-old boy, you got a great set of pipes on you. That's amazing. I can only imagine what your voice is going to sound like when you
I know.
When you get to your
Unfortunately, WVIP no longer exists. Oh, I have to say.
Yeah. Well, Dave Ross, appreciate you coming on. Appreciate you taking the time. And we'll have to have you on again so we can rip on my fellow conservatives at some point in time.
Yeah, of course. Thank you, Jack.
Wow. Dave Ross, what a great guy. What a gem, Diamond Dave Ross. All right, we'll take a really quick break. We'll be right back with Jason Rantz coming up right after this.
Hello, everybody. We got some more of the best of Cairo Nights right here for you. And this one's an interesting one. This is from a reporter and editor, Taylor Tassler from Bonneville, Phoenix, and she came on Cairo Nights a few weeks back to talk about how she was a witness of Arizona executing its first death row inmate in nearly 8 years.
First-time guest, Taylor Tassler from our sister station in Phoenix, Arizona, KTAR News. Taylor, thanks so much for joining the show. I got a really surreal email from our news director, Charlie, and he says, hey, there was an execution in Phoenix, and you should email this person, and you should have them on your show. And I said, okay, Charlie, I'm going to do that because I'm a great employee.
Always got to follow the boss's orders.
Yeah, when the boss man says, hey, get this story, get this scoop, Jack Stein's the guy who's all over it. So you actually went and you witnessed a human being put to death in the fine state of Arizona. I'm curious, what are the circumstances around this?
Yeah, so I witnessed it today. The execution started at 10 a.m. Basically, some background on the case. The man was named Clarence Dixon. He was 66 years old. He had murdered and raped a 21-year-old ASU student about 44 years ago. The case had gone cold for about 20 years. And when a cold case detective was running DNA samples and found a hit, 20 years later, that was Clarence Dixon's, because he was actually serving a life sentence for raping another college student.
Wow.
So, yes. So it was 44 years ago. And so today was the day of his execution. Obviously, it was a controversial day because Arizona hasn't had an execution in 8 years, because back in 2014, the state tried to execute Joseph Wood. And some call it botched, some don't call it botched, because at the end of the day, Joseph Wood did die, but it took him 2.5 hours to die when it's only supposed to take about 6 to 10 minutes.
Right. And I'm assuming that Clarence Dixon was lethal injection, correct?
It was lethal injection. So he actually had the opportunity to die by gas. We still have a working gas chamber here in Arizona. And
wow.
Yes.
Wow.
They refurbished it, I think, about 2 years ago, so that prisoners who had the option, I think if their crime was committed before 1992, they can choose to die by gas, which his crime was committed, if I want to say off the top of my head, 1978 was when he raped and murdered the ASU students. So he had the option. He actually never ended up choosing, and so legally it defaults to lethal injection.
So his attorneys said that he had schizophrenia, and this is, I guess, is the other reason why this is a controversy, and they were trying to say that he was not fit, that basically to stand trial. I guess in my assessment of that is, or I mean, this is always a tricky topic, right? Because at what point do we deem somebody mentally unwell when at the same time they have the capacity to plan and then plan an assault, a sexual assault and a rape, and then murder somebody. Do you know what I mean? That takes a certain amount of forethought from somebody. It's not exactly, doesn't read like a crime of passion or something like that, to me personally.
Exactly. And to go back to the schizophrenia, he had actually been on trial and the case was dropped because former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor ruled that he was mentally unfit to stand trial. Mm. And 2 days later, he committed this murder and rape that he was executed for today.
So, yeah, I mean, it just seems like a series of I'll tell you what it is. It's really it's really interesting to me that still in the United States, we have the death penalty and still there is some kind of a debate around it. And I understand both sides of it, but the thing that always kind of gets me tangled up in knots about it is, like, what do you do with that human being? And I'm not asking you to editorialize on this. This is more so my job. But what do you do with a human being like Clarence Dixon, who's like a dedicated predator? I don't know of any, like, rehabilitation services. What kind of life is that person going to have after that point? Like, you either let them live and rot effectively in prison, or what you do is you say, well, what is this? What kind of justice can the state administer? And at that point in time, it's like, yeah, I suppose the death penalty is the best solution for someone who is that dedicated of a predator, regardless of whatever mental state that they might be in. So for you being there as a reporter, what was that like to actually witness it? Was that an emotional experience or was it kind of a surreal experience?
I think it was surreal. Leading up to the event, I thought long and hard about whether I was going to take the opportunity or not. I spoke to multiple people at our station here in Phoenix and stations around Phoenix who have witnessed executions prior. And one of the best ways that it was put to me was, you know, we as journalists take on these burdens for the public. You know, we witness these horrible things so that we can then tell the public what we saw and keep them informed. And so that was a way I looked at it. You know, I'm doing my job so the public can stay informed and that there is this level of transparency, because in Arizona, at least, there has been some mishaps with the execution system here. And another way that I looked at it was, you know, I report on, you know, our criminal justice system constantly. And so this is, you know, the most final end of the criminal justice system. Mm. So, you know, it's the finality of it, the finality of a whole case. And so I really just felt like I was going in to do my job. And I thought I would be a little bit more nervous or rattled. But the minute I got in there and was watching everything happen and was taking notes, it very much became, this is my job and this is what I have to do. I have to take all the nerves, just kind of went away.
Were there any family members, any other, like anybody representing the victims or anything like that when this occurred?
Yes. So the sister of the victim was in the execution room, and I'm not positive. The Department of Corrections told us this, but they weren't positive either, that a friend of the victim was also there. And the sister spoke at the press conference as well. She's been, you know, very upfront with her feelings and goes to all of the court cases, everything throughout the entirety of this process.
Taylor Tassler, thank you so much for joining us. I really, really do appreciate it. KTR News is our sister station down in Phoenix. It's all under the Bonneville umbrella. And I really appreciate you willing to come on my little radio show and talk to me about this. Again, it was a weird set of circumstances that put us together. And this will never cease to be fascinating to me, our ongoing conversation around the death penalty and the administration of justice. And I appreciate very much so your willingness as a reporter to be there, even though, you know, for me, you're, what, 2,000 miles away. I appreciate very much your willingness to be there for the transparency for the nation at large. So thank you so much.
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much for having me and taking the time to talk with me.
We'll take a really quick break. We'll be right back right after this. We'll be right back.
One down and two more to go, folks, with the best of Cairo Nights. And this is one that happened quite recently, and it was a fun debate between me and Jack about some of the gray area behind rideshare scooters.
I have two thoughts about being right. Two thoughts. This is the end. So, Shane, do you remember when I was trying to warn everybody about e-scooters? Scoots, remember?
Talked about Scoot Gang. Yes, yes. Very much so, I remember.
I'm trying to warn the fine people of the Pacific Northwest that scooters or e-scooters are blights on a city. They are disgusting. Bird, lime, I don't care what it is. It's an awful idea. It's a terrible idea, and no city should be in favor of it. And I was confirmed right today, Shane. I just got to say, I was right.
I'm ready to hear this one because I disagree. I think that they're one of the best things that could have ever happened.
Ooh, wow. Okay. All right. Listen, Shane, here's the thing is that I am correct like 95% of the time on about 80% of things, which means that I'm batting like 1,000. So SDOT did a study, and they found that out of the 5,100 people who responded who had used scooters, that 11%, that is 1 out of 10, reported experiencing an injury. And again, that's according to the Seattle Department of Transportation. That is in the first year of the e-scooter pilot program. That is a sum total. 570 reported injuries. And these aren't like, ooh, my wrist hurts. Some of these people had concussions. Some of these people had broken bones. This is not something to scoff at. 48 injuries a month, Shane. 48 injuries a month related to the e-scooter program from that group of respondents. So while I think that, you know, it's this is all sad news, Shane, I do have to say this. I was right. I was totally right. I was 100% correct about this. Scooters are dangerous. I am a literal hero. I am literally saving lives one radio segment at a time. And people should thank me. Thank me, Shane, for being so right about this that it's physically painful for me. I told everybody, scooters, bikes, they're awful. And oh, by the way, my good friend Dr. Fred Rivara is an injury prevention expert at Harborview Medical Center. I've never met the man, but I'm a big old fan of Harborview. I think they do great work.
We're buds.
Said a lot of these injuries are serious. So anyway, Shane, I'm curious what your rebuttal to this could possibly be, being that I'm 100% right about this.
So let me just kind of run some of these numbers back. I'm a dyslexic kid, so let me know if I'm getting any of these wrong here. So you're telling me there's about average 48 injuries a month, 48 incidents a month with these scooters,
yeah,
injuries, and that went up to around 780 around that ballpark. That's like kind of the amount of injuries they had for the first year, correct?
570.
Yeah. There we go. This is why I asked for clarification. When I hear those numbers, Jack, all I think about is, I wonder how many of those people ski in jeans. I wonder how many of those people really, you know, like to rollerblade in their spare time. How many of those people really don't harness the Narness or live hardcore like a lot of other people like myself and my friends do when it comes to riding these scooters. And listen, also, let's put the humor aside. How many of those were alcohol related? You know, how many of those people who actually got hurt, those injuries? Because listen, hanging out in the U District, going out when I was in college and coming to Seattle, we were ripping the scooters. Trust me. We were all ripping the scooters. One time, we couldn't get an Uber, so we had a gang of about 12 dudes rolling deep with the scoots. And let me tell you, there was curb jumping and steep hills, and we did have a brother fall, and he got eaten up pretty good because it was in pretty old asphalt. But he also had done an enormous amount of drugs and alcohol. So what were we supposed to do? Things happen like that. So when I hear these injuries, I think about the people that aren't living as hardcore as they should.
But this is my point, Shane, an excellent rant, is that while there are benefits to the scooting and, you know, having guys go 12 scoots deep at the same time, and that's a technical term. Shane and I didn't make that up. At the same time, you also have to recognize that there is the opportunity here for someone to get either severely injured and or die. And yes, I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that are skateboarding on flip-flops, if you catch my drift. Mm. There's a lot of people out there who are not wearing their pads, not wearing their helmets,
no wrist guards.
But in my estimation, this is enough evidence just to do away with the entirety of the program, and we need to move on with our lives. Speaking of, by the way, Mr. Billy Sunshine is going to be on in a couple of few, and I'm positive Billy still wants to talk about abortion. So we'll touch on that subject when we get back right after this.